Man, I love this song. And like the Warren Zevon character in this classic Lawyers, Guns, and Money, our next guest is also a globetrotting guy who's been in some tight spots in bad places. His name is Bill Burns, William Burns. He's, when I say he's prolific, I'm not kidding. He's a New York Times bestselling author, a magazine publisher, a New York literary publishing agent, who's written and edited more than 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal. But you probably remember him best as the guy with the shades in the UFO Hunters TV series that aired for three seasons on the History Channel. His name is Bill Burns, and he's back with two new books. One is a companion piece to the TV series, UFO Hunters Book 2, with a look kind of behind the scenes at how the program was put together, things that never made it onto the air. The other is a tell-all autobiography of a Hollywood legend, Mickey Rooney, and this story will knock your socks off once you hear some of the tragic twists and turns that it took. In a moment, Bill Burns. Stay with us. More to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I always enjoy having Bill Burns as my guest because not many people have the depth and breadth of his knowledge, the database in his head about UFOs and related topics. Bill, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Oh, thank you, George. Good to be here.
Let's, before we jump into talking about the first of your two new books, I wanted to segue from the first hour we had with John Greenwald, and I don't know if you were able to listen to it, but we talked about the releases, the PR machine that was cranked up by the CIA and the FBI in connection with the, quote, real X-Files, and they both posted stuff on their websites. Look at what we've got, how open and honest we're being and candid. I just want to get your take on that, what's going on there.
Well, when you look at the CIA history of the UFOs, and there is one and it's wide open, anybody can find it on the CIA website, what you find out is that they were happily using UFOs as a cover for a lot of what they were doing. And I remember back when we were doing UFO Hunters, our paths would cross with people who'd work for the CIA. In one case, it was an active non-official cover agent. And they would say things to us along the lines of, it's a good thing there really are UFOs, because if there were no UFOs, we would have had to have invented them. I mean, it was an open secret among the special access people inside the CIA that we were dealing with UFOs, that they were tracked in our atmosphere. And among the higher echelons of the military, there was also a special access group that was in communication. And in fact, one of the aspects of the CIA, and this is a current story, this is actually, you can find this in the New York Times today, is that the CIA was actually running cover stories to its own employees. So even if you worked for the CIA, you really weren't sure what was true and what was not, because they were disseminating false information within the agency just in case somebody decided to talk. So, and that covered UFOs as well as a whole range of other things. But the CIA was intimately involved with UFOs all the way back, starting right after the passage of the National Security Act and at the beginning of the agency as early as late 1947, early 1948.
You know, the CIA has gotten a lot of mileage out of just what you were saying, but I think some of it undeserved. I mean, years later, after the SR-71 and U-2 spy plane programs are defunct, they issue this report saying, yeah, you remember all those UFOs from the 50s and 60s? That was us, which, of course, is ridiculous. You know, I mean, the number of UFO sightings, the fact that they don't look like flying saucers, these planes we're talking about, that they don't hover over lake beds and over people's homes. They've also, you know, spun it in another direction that might be useful for them, but is patently ridiculous.
Yes, but the other thing the CIA did, and this is what we learned from the Soviets. What the CIA did was they went to a lot of their friends in Hollywood, at the studios. And what they said was, they gave them stories, and these basically movies like This Island Earth, Invaders from Mars, It Came from Outer Space, all the big flying saucer movies and alien creature movies of the early 1950s, right through the 1950s. And they encouraged these producers and these writers to make these movies. And they had a, their reasoning was brilliant. And it was, and it went something like this. Let's just say we're walking down the street in downtown Chicago, we see a UFO. And we start screaming bloody murder, they're here, run for your lives, the Martians are coming. Well, if you've seen three or four of these movies, somebody saying that is going to be looked at, is going to be totally marginalized. Just another person, just like the movie, screaming about UFOs, the body snatchers, they're here. Well, they did that for a very specific reason. By creating a fiction about flying saucers and UFOs and creatures from outer space and invaders from Mars, they basically took the entire issue off the mainstream table and they put it on the fiction table so that everybody thought that you were either a nutcase or it was simply fiction. And that worked so well for UFOs that that continues to this day, so that if you want to marginalize something, shunt it off to the motion picture industry, to the television industry, and they'll do the job for you. And that's exactly what the CIA did as early as the early 1950s.
Let me ask you another sort of a contextual question, and then we'll get into the book. Some interesting stuff going on. In addition to the FBI and CIA posting these documents, making it seem like it's new and candid and they're being upfront about the topic and posting it on multiple kinds of social media, drawing attention to it, we've had some discussion in the presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton talking about being asked and not scoffing at the question, sort of taking on seriously, yeah, I'd like to know, and if I get elected president, I'm going to poke into this stuff and look around, which is the same thing her husband has said. He's been on a couple of talk shows. Obama has made wisecracks about Area 51. There have been, even Marco Rubio got into it. I mean, there is still sort of a laughter factor, but it's also not as much as before. And I just wondered if you have any thoughts on what's going on. Has there been sort of a cultural shift, or am I reading too much into it?
Well, on the one hand, I think the joke is wearing thin. So, I mean, Steve Bassett has made comments about this, that, yeah, when Hillary Clinton was asked by up in New Hampshire to make a comment about UFOs, she said, yeah, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Now, she has said that. Bill Clinton, you're right. Her husband, Bill Clinton, when he was president, tasked Webster Hubble to try and get to the bottom of the whole UFO question. Jimmy Carter, when he was running for president, made a flat-out campaign of a statement that he was going to tell the truth to the American people about UFOs. And then supposedly someone walked into the Oval Office, think somebody with one of those unlimited access passes like Zbigniew Brzezinski, walks into the Oval Office and says, this will destroy your presidency and really put your family in harm's way, so don't do it. And one time at a book signing, I actually tried to ask Jimmy Carter a question about it, and he had this really blank look on his face when he looked up and wouldn't answer. And yet, Jimmy Carter made a UFO sighting report in Georgia. The other person, I think one of the most intriguing statements about a presidential quasi-disclosure was Ronald Reagan. Reagan had two UFO sightings, two important UFO sightings, both of which he talked about. One was when he and Nancy Reagan were driving down the Pacific Coast Highway. They were going to a birthday party for Bill Holden, the actor William Holden. We all remember him from the movie Network. And right over PCH, the Pacific Coast Highway, he saw this UFO hovering over the highway, and it shot out over into Santa Monica Bay. And Reagan was so, like, excited about this that when he got to the party, it was at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, when he got to the party, he basically told everybody, and Lucille Ball, I Love Lucy, she actually mentioned this to her friends, and that's how I found out about it from Lucille Ball. The other big sighting happened when he was governor, and he was flying from Los Angeles back up to Sacramento, and they spotted a UFO on the way up, and he directed his pilot to chase the UFO. And they chased it all the way out into the Mojave Desert. And the UFO simply shot away. When they landed in Sacramento, the first person that Reagan spoke to was the Sacramento bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. And he says, I saw a UFO, and I'm going to tell Nancy. So, I mean, so he says these two things. He says them in public. He reports his UFO sighting. And then at crucial moments, the meeting with Gorbachev and Reykjavik and making a speech before the UN, he refers to what would happen if the United States, if the world faced a threat from an extraterrestrial entity, and says we'd all get together and national borders wouldn't matter. Now, it's funny because he says that, and then all the way back in 1952, that's kind of exactly what retired General Douglas MacArthur said about UFOs when he told the New York Times that the next major threat the world would face would be from creatures from outer space. So this has been bubbling beneath the surface. And of course, remember Harry Truman, we talk about disclosure, Harry Truman on television, and there is a piece of film about this, actually says these are flying saucers and we know what they are. So as far back as 1950, we actually had official presidential disclosure to the press that flying saucers existed and that the second half was the government knows what they are. So this has just been a long line of from 1950 all the way to the present of chief executives saying that they want to get to the bottom of the whole UFO question. And then there's the whole Kennedy stuff, which you could spend hours talking about that.
Let's talk about your new UFO book, UFO Hunters Book 2. Book 1 was terrific, and the series was terrific. I just thought it was a genuine and open and honest attempt to get some answers on these things. The book is fun. It's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. The series, of course, is gone, but it lives on in a sense. It begat Ancient Aliens, which seems to be unstoppable. Do you miss the show? I mean, it was hard stuff. You can tell from your book, it was hard. All this travel, the places you'd go, get into some hairy situations, but do you miss it?
I do. I mean, it was a wonderful show. One of the things that I liked best about the show was that it took... So you take three shows and you line them up. So the old UFO files from the late 80s into the 90s, UFO Hunters, and then Ancient Aliens. And both Ancient Aliens, which really is UFO files for Ancient Aliens. I mean, it's the same format. Because I've written some of those episodes. And so it is exactly the same format. It is, you state a premise, which was Ancient Aliens built the pyramids, true or false. And then your arguments are why Ancient Aliens built the pyramids, because A, how they're aligned with the stars, how they're aligned with the Earth's grid, why tools back then couldn't have done the cutting they did, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the premise, and it was an argument. There was no real debate on the show. UFO Hunters took an entirely different tack. And that tack was not so much to prove that UFOs were real, but it was to look at the arguments that the skeptics and debunkers raised about specific cases. And where those arguments were valid and legitimate arguments, then those arguments could be sustained. Where the arguments were not, then what you're left with was the stuff that had to be investigated. So the premise was really Sherlock Holmes. In the first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, one of the things that Sherlock Holmes tells Dr. Watson, he says that the idea of the elimination of arguments you can refute always leaves you with something you can investigate. And so that's how we approached UFO Hunters. In fact, that's why in the dedication to the book, we dedicated it to Leonard Nimoy, because the show was really based on Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of. And the other one was in this one Star Trek episode, The Gamesters of Triskelion, where everybody, where Kirk and the crew disappear. They're being transported to a planet, and they suddenly disappear off the sensors. Nobody knows where they are. And the whole bridge crew is screaming, where'd they go?" But what Spock sees is that there's an ion trail leading out into space. And the ion trail is not supposed to be there. It's a trace. It's a physical trace. So Spock takes the whole Enterprise to follow the ion trail while Dr. McCoy is screaming, "You're out of your Vulcan mind. You're out of your Vulcan mind. Why are you going there? Search the planet." Sure enough, he gets to Triskelion, where the crew has been abducted. And the premise of that is, when there are no other solutions, you follow the one lead you have, even though it looks like a strange lead because you've eliminated everything else. And that was what we did in each UFO Hunter episode. So you look at all the things you can eliminate. So you take something like Maury Island, which was the first episode. It wasn't the first episode we shot. It was the first one that aired. So you take that episode, and you look at every single debunker explanation. And every single explanation worked. There really was no flying donut over the Harold Dahl boat. When Kenneth Arnold went to investigate the Harold Dahl boat, he found no damage on the boat. Why did the B-25 Mitchell bomber go down over Kelso? Was it some strange, weird UFO material? Was it the slag that blew the plane up? No. What it was the material on Maury Island, because there was a smelting plant right across the sound, was iron slag. It was very heavily magnetic material. It was ferrous. What would happen in the B-25 Mitchell bomb bay, which is where the pilots stored the box of material from Maury Island? There was a junction box. So what would happen if you put heavily magnetized material next to a junction box? Well, the junction box wouldn't trip, wouldn't break the circuit. In fact, it overrode the circuit and caused an electrical fire that spread to the wing. And that's exactly what the two technical sergeants who were on board that B-25, who were ordered to jump when the B-25 caught fire. So we figured out there was a logical explanation for what happened to Harold Dahl, why he waited until after the Kenneth Arnold sighting to go public, and what brought the plane down, and what would happen if that material was sitting next to a junction box where we know it was sitting in the Bombay. So that was a big debunking episode. The best thing about that episode was, why were these two pilots, these two Army CIC pilots, right before the services broke up, why were they dispatched from California up to Washington? That made absolutely no sense until you realized that one of those pilots, Frank Brown, Lieutenant Frank Brown, the entire Kenneth Arnold sighting, wrote this glowing report of Kenneth Arnold. And when Kenneth Arnold was asked to investigate the Harold Dahl sighting, because Kenneth Arnold was involved, that's what brought Frank Brown up in the B-25.
I thought it was interesting in the beginning of this new book, the UFO Hunters Book 2, you make the point that, as you're saying, that it was not the purpose of the program to prove that UFOs are real. And you say you'd never want to be pounding your fist on the table because there are physiological things, neurological wiring in humans that make us believe what we believe. Thought that was a really interesting point. We got to go to a break in about a minute, but maybe you can talk about it for that time.
Sure. I mean, human beings are hardwired in some cases to believe what they believe. And so they did neurological studies, CAT scans, of people who were given arguments that comported with their belief system. And certain parts of their brains lit up. Then they were given arguments that actually disputed fundamentally what their belief system told them. And different parts of their brains lit up. So we know that that from a neurobiological standpoint, human beings are hardwired. Adults are hardwired to believe certain kinds of things that reinforce their belief systems and to reject things out of hand, no matter what the level of logic.
We're talking with Bill Burns, Mr. UFO hunter himself. In a moment, we jump back into his book, too, sort of a behind-the-scenes guide to what it was like working on that famous TV show, and a lot more to come still on Coast to Coast. Ray Charles with a beautiful song takes us into the break. The song is called Oh Well, one of the earliest, and I'd argue, best hits for this classic rock band, Fleetwood Mac, back before the current incarnation, back when Peter Green was sort of the front man for the band. Oh Well, good song. We're talking with Bill Burns in this hour about his new book, UFO Hunters Book 2, sort of the behind-the-scenes look at the TV series and some of the cases that were covered during Season 2. We're going to jump right into a couple of those cases, some you've heard of and maybe some you haven't, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Burns, one of the things I enjoyed most about your new book, UFO Hunters Book 2, was sort of the occasional commentary about the nature of the beast, that is, working on a show for a cable network and the politics of it, and how you never quite know what's going to happen and how you get on the air and how you stay on the air. Can you talk about why this show isn't on the air now? Seems like the level of public interest in the topic is rarely, if ever, been higher. Why isn't it still there?
Well, first of all, it costs too much. It costs too much, and the network itself was changing. If you look at the kinds of shows that History is carrying now, they're doing some scripted stuff, scripted series. And they moved a lot of the reality doc shows, UFO Hunters, Ancient Aliens, Ice Road Truckers, porn stars. These are called reality documentaries. They moved them to H2, which is the kind of lower budget part of the network, the lower budget channel. So that was the first thing. There was a change in the way History Channel was doing its programming. That meant that shows that were really expensive, I mean, when we were doing the Nazi UFO episode, for example, in season 3, we were in Germany, Peenemünde, on the Baltic Sea. Then we went to Poland because of the Nazi bell, that whole segment of that episode. Because of that, that was something like $350,000 for 1 hour of camera time. And that's outrageously expensive. So the show was simply too expensive to put on. But then there was the incident at Delcy. And this was right before we went over to Europe. We were faced with, we had two conflicting stories of Delcy. One was, these were flying saucers. And we stayed on the Hickory Apache Reservation. We were talking to the folks on the reservations, the Hickory Apache, and they were telling us about UFOs they'd seen over the site, strange animals climbing up and down the Archuleta Mesa. We spoke to various residents talking about the firefight with the aliens, and so we went through the lore of Delcy. But then we looked at other aspects of Delcy. Why were there cattle mutilations around the mesa? Why was there the strange caravan of black vans at 3 and 4 in the morning leaving the Delcy area heading toward Albuquerque? You know, maybe sometimes 10, 15 cars in a caravan. Why? We talked to tribal police officers who talked about the various strange animals they saw, foxes with heads of rabbits. And I mean, these are anecdotal stories, so nobody had a photograph for us. Then we spoke to Gabe Valdez. And Gabe Valdez told us the story of how when he was still working as a state police officer, a state trooper, he pulled up on a cow alongside the road with a helicopter with strange markings on it. It wasn't a black helicopter. It wasn't an unmarked one. It had strange markings on it. A helicopter hovering over the dead cow. He pulls up, lights and siren are on. The helicopter speeds off. They look at the cow, and it's dead, but there it's with calf. So they call a veterinarian. They open up the womb, and sure enough, there is a fetus inside, a bovine fetus, but it has a human head. And Gabe Valdez snapped a series of photographs of that animal. And there was a big discussion at the network. Do we air this photo? I mean, this is like beyond the realm of UFOs. It's almost into kind of like a Fox Mulder X-Files episode at this point. What is this thing? Why was there a human head on a bovine fetus? And why was there a human hand? What was going on with this particular animal? Well, sure enough, we aired it. And that was in March of 2009. In April of 2009, Senators Grassley, Graham, and Mary Landrieu from Louisiana all submit a bill in the Senate making it a crime under Title 18. Title 18 is the federal penal code. Under Title 18, to interbreed humans and animals. Now, I'm not going to say this is a, you know, one caused the other, but I'm going to say the timing is very, very suspicious. So now we go to Andros Island. It's later in the spring, right? We're on Andros Island, and we're told, wow, the ratings are so high. You guys, I hope you settle in for like two more seasons. Now we go out to Long Island, and we're going to talk about Brookhaven. And there is the strange person, very sartorial gentleman, introduces himself to me off camera, asks if we can sit down and have a chat some morning, lives in the area. Love to talk to you, grab some coffee. We do that. And he tells me, this is your last season, by the way. I'm surprised. Why? Why is that? He says, well, you guys really, I mean, on the one hand, when you were at Area 51 last year, and yeah, the Tickaboo Peak segment, where you guys climbed up Tickaboo Peak and shot that high-intensity camera on that big hangar at sunrise, you got a lot of people mad. But what really got people mad was when you were sitting in that hotel room over McCarran Airport reading the tail numbers on the Janet airline jets, then running those tail numbers through the FAA database and saying these Janet airline planes belong to the federal government and they were headed out to Area 51. That got a lot of people even more angry. So on the one hand, that was your last strike until you guys aired that crazy Dulcie photograph. Don't you know that the toes you stepped on when you aired that photograph were so big, you are in an area, it's almost like you don't want to do this. Back away from this. These people are bigger than you, meaner than you, uglier than you, and it's not about UFOs. So this is the end of you guys, so enjoy your season. And sure enough, within a week, we were told that the ratings had plummeted. And we knew they hadn't because we were beating The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But your ratings had plummeted and we're changing the way we do our budgets. The show's too expensive. You guys are going off the air. So episodes later, we're speaking to Nancy Talbot of BLT Research, very famous person. And she tells us, do you understand what you did at Dulcie? And we're kind of scratching our heads. Yeah, it was about the aliens and the humans and they're doing biological research and interbreeding. She said, no. On the one hand, you know that when there's in vitro fertilization, the human ovum cells, they are cultivated in bovine serum. So that's very close to human serum on the one hand. Imagine if you were a major pharmaceutical company working with the United States military, and what you were doing were growing organs, specific organs, in cattle. Imagine how big that would be, A, for the military, and B, for medicine in general. Imagine people who can afford this being able to live 150 to 200 years because you could replace an organ the way you replace an alternator in your car. Just imagine that. And that's what you guys stepped into and blew the whistle on it. And now you have these people in the Senate, these senators, saying you can't do this anymore. And this is a multi-billion dollar industry that you guys have just exposed. And so I think that was the death knell for the show.
You know, someone's been carrying out those dissections of cattle and other animals for a long time now. And I think it's more than one outfit doing this stuff. And somebody's been doing it. Humans have been doing it under the umbrella of all the weirdness of cattle mutilations, getting away with it and blaming it, letting the public blame it on aliens or whatever, but doing it for very understandable, down-to-earth, if sneaky reasons. You know, my colleague, Dr. Colm Kelleher, had written about it, that the mutilations may be related to tracking the spread of some bad stuff like mad cow through the food chain. The similarities of human blood and bovine blood have been noted before by other researchers, Linda Howe and such. The similarities between things that went on at the Skinwalker Ranch in Utah and Dulce have been investigated by the same guys who worked on the ranch. So I think you might be onto something there. It's really creepy. It's really creepy.
Colm is absolutely right, because one of the things that one of the problems with mad cow disease is that it's not something that's instant like the flu. I mean, it takes, in some cases, a decade to fester. And so imagine what would happen. I mean, this is frightening stuff. Imagine what would happen if this stuff began getting into beef in the fast food chains. I mean, you would be infecting an entire population, and you're not going to know this unless you're testing the cattle. But imagine telling the whole world, well, the United States, the Department of Agriculture is buying up all these cows, is buying up all these herds because we want to test for mad cow disease. Imagine freaking out an entire world buying American beef. So you're going to have to do it on the sly. Well, how do you do it on the sly? Well, A, you test selective animals, and you do it in such a way that always blame the alien. You know, it's like the guy on Star Trek, the guy wearing the red suit. You know that's the guy that's going to die in the original series. Always blame it on the aliens. So UFOs, again, very convenient, and it's a great way to test cattle. And where will things like, for example, radiation from grass? Look at all the above-ground nuclear testing we did back in the 1950s in the United States, right in that area, right in those areas, Nevada, Colorado, places like that. What better way to find out how much the ground has absorbed poisonous radiation than testing the cattle that are eating the grass?
You know, it always seemed to me there was something hinky about the show not being on the air anymore. I can understand the expense, but there are other ways you could do the show. I mean, you could change it. You don't have to necessarily, it wouldn't be the same, but you could do a version of the show where you don't have to travel to the scene. You just get talking heads, throw up some standard video. I think the model that Ancient Aliens uses, I mean, they're on the air. I suspect they're a lot cheaper to produce than you were, but they're also not as in the face. This is stuff that happened a long time ago. It is not as threatening as the kinds of things that you explored.
Ancient Aliens is the safest show about UFOs that I've ever seen. You're not talking about conspiracies. You're talking about everybody's been dead for 7,000 years. And look at what, I mean, there are things that would be great to see on that show, because that show started. The whole premise of Ancient Aliens began, Pat Uskert and I were pushing that show ever since the middle of season one on UFO Hunters, saying that nobody's ever done a show about the ancients. There are all these great legends from the local Native American tribes in the Southwest all the way to ancient Sumer. Nobody's ever done it. And so we were pushing Giorgio Tsoukalos and Eric Mondanigan, saying somebody should do a show about Chariots of the Gods. That was that show was on in the 1970s and 80s. Let's do it again. So finally, in the first episode of season three, the Giant Triangles episode, we got our chance. because Giorgio had this little the Tulumer fighter, the Tulumer fighter, and so that was how we began Ancient Aliens, by having our specialty producer, our effects producer, Brick Price, up in the valley, scale up the little artifact that Giorgio always wore around his neck, the Tulumer fighter. And the plan was, if that thing could glide, don't put an engine on it, don't make any changes to it, just absolutely scale it up exactly the way it is, launch it from a height, see if it flies. If it does, that tells you one thing about what these Mesoamericans would have seen. And we did. And it flew. And that became the basis for Ancient Aliens. And it was a very, very inexpensive show to produce. I mean, UFO files cost roughly, when you think about moving a crew of, there was a lighting guy, there was a sound person, there was a camera person, and a segment producer. So you're talking about four people plus your guest. And four people plus a guest, then you've got editing expenses. So figure it would cost about $25,000 an hour, which is really a good price
yeah.
for an hour
yeah.
of television. Compare that to $350,000 an hour. I mean, there's the difference. Well, Ancient Aliens cost roughly maybe in those dollars in that time, 10 years ago, basically $30,000 an hour. The biggest expense was that the production company had to license all of Eric Von Daniken's library. And that was really the largest expense of the show, besides the basic below-the-line production expense.
Well, Giorgio's not here, so I'm not going to go on a rant about Ancient Aliens. I would just say, since you write for the program, though, I think at some point it runs out of material, because now we've got Ancient Aliens pretty much everywhere. They're involved in everything. They built everything.
Right. I mean, and that was, and that's the false premise of the show. I mean, one of the things that you could do is you could, well, Michael Heiser did it, and this person, Christopher Smith, did it. You could have counter arguments to show that, no, the lines really aren't straight. And yes, if you look at the blocks in Machu Picchu, yes, you could see the marks where the stones were hoisted. If you realize that you could build up dirt mounds on long inclines up to build the pyramids, that's how they move the blocks up there. I mean, you could come up with, this is the whole Sherlock Holmesian approach, you could come up with conventional explanations for all of these megaliths and for all of these artifacts. I mean, one of the big things was, why are these Egyptian villages, ancient Egyptian villages, why do they look exactly like certain constellations, like the constellation around Cygnus? Well, there's a reason for that. They saw the stars, they built their villages because they believed the deities lived in the stars. That's a conventional explanation for that. It didn't mean that people came down from outer space and populated these villages. So, I mean, there are conventional explanations for all this stuff. When you take it to the extent where they take it, that is, everything was built by Ancient Aliens, what you're basically saying is, how did human beings survive? We were as as dumb as the rocks. We lifted up the mountaintops. So,
yeah, I think at some point it does a disservice to the topic. I am not going to harp on the program. I'm sort of glad it's gone as well as it has. But at some point it does a disservice if you say everything was built by aliens. At some point people stop believing any of it.
Right. I mean, what I would love to do, I mean, there are such exciting excavations and discoveries going on now in the Middle East. I mean, for example, right near the Temple Mount, there was a series of excavations, and they uncovered the seal of one of the biblical kings, King Hezekiah. Now, here's the startling thing for me, and I have not seen anybody talk about this.
I'll tell you what, hold that thought, Bill, because we're going to be going to a break here. When we come back on the other side, I'll let you finish this story, and then I'm going to ask you one case that you go into in the book. It's one that you cross paths with me from 2008, Houseboat Bob and the strange thing that slammed into the Colorado River, and these Men in Black characters who showed up. And then we'll shift gears and talk about Mickey Rooney a little bit. James Brown, Night Train, take us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.